Andrew Thorpe King, Failure. He wrote a book on failure. It's called Failure Rules. He goes through five of the lessons, of the great rules that he's learned. He's been at the bottom. He's on government assistance. He's failed at personal, family relationships, businesses. He's a record label. He had record labels. He was a bodybuilder. He wrote spy novels. He's a fascinating, fascinating man. And the book is really, really good. He's written it. I believe it took him over 10 years. Failure purifies. Nothing is safe. Money is spiritual. I'm not going to tell you the last two, but just the lessons learned. Keep your attachments internal. Great quotes in there from, he quotes Tony Soprano. If you can quote the rules, you can obey them. Just a fantastic conversation on failure and how he's turned his life, his careers around. I really enjoyed my conversation with Andrew, and I know you're going to like it too. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Joey Pins. People ask me, how did I lose 130 pounds? The quick answer is always discipline. I started my business, wasn't paying attention to my health, was eating too much, drinking too much sweets. My daughter was born. Next thing I know, I'm pre-diabetic, I have hypertension. I knew something had to change. Discipline. I, like many of you, have faced many challenges in your career, in your family, in your life, in your faith. How did you attack them? How did you approach them? How did you solve them, hopefully? It all had to have some degree of discipline. I'm also asked, how did you found and start a tech business that lasted over 25 years? Discipline. I was committed to it, enjoyed technology, didn't enjoy some aspects of it, but knew it was necessary. Discipline. Our podcast mission, how do we use discipline to better ourselves and society? Join me, please, as I talk to interesting people and discuss how they use discipline in their family, in their passion, in their careers, and how it helped them. Our podcast vision, growth through learning from others. Joey Pins Discipline Conversations. It'll be light and serious. Join us, please. Thank you for consideration.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad to hear that you had a chance to read it, even if it wasn't the whole thing. And ready to get into it, buddy.
Andrew Thorpe King. Good to meet you. Yeah, nice to meet you. So at what point, what did it take for you to learn that failure was such a great teacher, perhaps the best teacher of all?
Well, going through a lot of it, obviously that's going to, inculcate my reaction towards it. But I think it was realizing that bold action and failure are, two travelers that you can't, pull apart. Mm. They travel together. If you're going to take bold action, if you're going to live your life kind of loudly and have an eventful life, you're also going to have to deal with failure. Now, obviously, you're going to try to avoid it, but you're going to have to deal with it. So, from a discipline perspective, it became clear to me after two or three failures, particularly some that were extremely stressful and instructive, that, I ought to step back and actually think about this more deliberately and kind of create some discipline around how I anticipate failure, plan to metabolize it, leverage it, and then kind of, like Nassim Taleb writes about in Anti-Fragile, use it as a mechanism to not only be resilient and get up from it, but to grow from it and gain from it, gain from that which harms you, like a hydra multiplying in strength afterwards. So again, this isn't failure porn. I'm not advocating to induce failure, go after it, inappropriately celebrate it. But I think that we don't teach our culture enough that this is part of the road if you're going to try to do something difficult, if you're going to try to do something that might have a chance to actually utilize your full talent stack and allow you to really, put out your highest usefulness in the world and the most unique output. That if you're going to go that path, that kind of off-road path, you ought to think about failure and how you're going to encounter it, you know, ahead of time.
Yeah, I mean, our society, perhaps it's an American thing, but we really, really punish failure. I mean, in athletics, in business, I mean, we really, really do. I wonder why that is. Any thoughts?
I think it's optics. I think it's expectations. I think it's very dependent on culture and subculture and the optics of family and friends. And, you know, I think so many people, when they're thinking about life direction, who they want to be in the world, who they think they ought to be, who they think is going to be their most representative self, they kind of put trial balloons out to the wrong people. Mm. They put them out to the people that happen to be around them, the family they happen to be born into, the friends that happen to be, you know, naturally around them. Not that family and friends are at all bad. They're great. But I think that sometimes when we have these decisions to contemplate, we need to deal with them a little more in secret. We need to be reflective and kind of be non-attached to the external noise. Not that we don't take input from key mentors, but we need to be a little more choosy about that. So I think back to, like, you know, Warren Buffett talking about, don't tell people your dreams, develop them in secret. Hmm. When I did my bodybuilding show, when I wrote my first spy novel, when I started my record labels, I formed all these things in secret and didn't tell anybody about them until they already had enough form that they were real. So I was informing people, not telling them about an idea. It was no longer an idea, right? It wasn't this delicate idea that could be susceptible to you know, negative input and reflexive, you know, fear from people. And I think so many people get to that point, they voice an idea quickly because it just came to them and they're not sure about it. And instead of really evaluating it with a sound mind and maybe looking at other people, virtual mentors in the world that have gone that path, mm-hmm. and see what their route might have been, they reflexively bounce it off of family and friends. And that's the wrong audience most of the time for you know, any sort of really bold idea or ambitious or even risky, you know, dream, entrepreneurial or otherwise.
Yeah, I know we've both talked to people who had bold ideas, but, you know, didn't want to move forward with them because of failure, afraid of failure. And, you know, I was fortunate. I started my business when I was very young. I didn't have any kids. I didn't have a mortgage. I didn't even have a car payment, if I recall, you know, so I was just had an old beat up car. So I wasn't afraid to fail, you know, at a certain point, but
yeah,
but others are maybe afraid to do so because of such logistics put on, you know. You mentioned record labels, spy novels, bodybuilding, such a fascinating. I want to talk about the record label business. How is the record industry? How is it?
Sure. So, I mean, I'm in a very specific space, yeah. Right? I'm in underground metal, hardcore, and punk rock. So it's not really representative of the overall music industry. It's its own tribe. Been doing that for over 20 years with various intensities. Sometimes I'll pause for several years and I'll engage some bands and put out a batch of records and pause for another, you know, another few years. And that's usually how I do it. But, you know, on the aggregate over the past 20 plus years between two record labels with two different aesthetics, I've released over, you know, over 100 records. And, you know, I think these days it's very different because I think it's, you know, artists are in an amazing place where they've had so many gatekeepers dismantled from disintermediation, which is amazing. It does make record labels, less needed. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a great thing for artists. But they are still needed sometimes for branding and particularly for financing, right? I mean, if a band needs to raise a lot of money for manufacturing, you know, these days it's usually just physical vinyl that they'll sell on the road, sometimes CDs or merchandise, or they need money for marketing or advertising, or just to tap into the infrastructure of a record label that knows the nuances in and out of marketing and has a connection, has that piping in there. So, you know, I think there's still a place for that, but it is less and less. There's more power to the artist. And so I think this is actually a great time for artists, a tougher time for record labels, but they're certainly not, you know, out of having any fit in the ecosystem.
One of my favorite quotes from Prince, they asked him, you know, how is the record business? And his reply was, I'm not in the record business. I'm in the music business.
Right. Well, and it's like anything else, right? You think about, I think a lot of people, particularly artists, they get into a space and they think of it very kind of in a siloed way. Like, I'm an artist. I make music. I sell music. or me. I'm writing a book. I'm selling books. But the reality is I'm not selling books. I'm selling a message. The book is just one primary springboard to get that message out to the world. I'm also doing videos. I also have a soundtrack playlist attached to the book. Yeah. I also have a merchandise line that echoes the ethos and the slogans of the book. So you have to have a portfolio pursuits mindset, you know, thinking of like Walt Disney, where his main thing was movies, right? But guess what? Guess what finances movies when he was broke? It was the money he made off the watch with Mickey on it. It was this ancillary, adjacent possible, a prototized watch with a mouse on it that ended up being the thing that financed the rest of his vision. So you got to think wide. You got to think with, you know, different tentacles and build, you know, for that type of redundancy. You know, when you're an artist, when you're an entrepreneur, you can't just think just siloed, like I do this, this is what I do. You have to kind of really broaden out, you know, from the get-go and design it that way.
Andrew, your book, Your Failure Rules, I mean, incredible. Just so many, so many nuggets. You go through five rules and you have, you know, some great points along with them. But one of the, and your videos on YouTube are excellent done. They're cut Thank really you. Well. They whip back and forth. It's hard to stop them. My favorite is PMA, the positive mental attitude. And of course, you're such an advocate. I believe you got a tattoo of it as well. Let's talk about positive mental attitude.
Sure. So, you know, strangely, that originated from the self-help guru Napoleon Hill, who many are skeptical about from being, you know, potentially not so authentic. Right. So there's that history there. But it doesn't matter to me, right? I mean, whatever he was or wasn't, his message carried through and has, you know, survived and influenced a lot of people. So I discovered PMA from the Rastafarian iconic punk band, The Bad Brains, who had a song Attitude, which was talking about having that PMA. And that was a strange kind of injection into the punk rock scene, which was often steeped in nihilism and rebellion. Of course, it's punk rock. But, you know, The Bad Brains brought in this positive mental attitude kind of ethos. That was then echoed by later bands like H2O, like the Cro-Mags, the singer for the Cro-Mags, John Joseph, who's a triathlete just like you and a devotee of a Hare Krishna faith and an author himself. You know, he really preaches the PMA, has a book called The PMA Effect. John wrote the foreword to Failure Rules. And so this is kind of like this, you know, sub ethos of the punk rock culture, particularly older guys, right? And it's just something that has always resonated with me. And it doesn't mean that you don't acknowledge strife, anxiety, depression, negative feelings, the difficulty of that in loved ones. You know, so I do this video where I quote Marcus Aurelius, which is, you know, be tolerant with others, but strict with yourself. Mm. And so I try to apply that to my PMA. Like if I'm around somebody who's struggling, I'm not going to give them some sort of hollow, platitude, rah-rah speeches on PMA. You know, you have to lead with empathy and love in your own life. If you're able, you leverage PMA as much as possible to catapult you through hard times. But, you know, it's kind of a personal thing. And that's kind of how I view it and try to embody it.
Your number one rule, failure purifies. The nugget that I just had to kind of keep rereading and pause and come back to was keep your attachments internal. Very, it's kind of go what you just said with Warren Buffett. Don't tell anybody with your dreams. Very, very poignant.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's something I learned from being in various states of ascension and collapse over the first two decades of my adult life, 20s and my 30s. Having risen and fallen many times, having moved more times than I can imagine for various impetuses, and gone in and out of very different socioeconomic states. And you just learn to have this nimbleness where you're not attached to anything. I live in a very nice house now. I drive a Cadillac. I smoke 3 cigars a day. I have a hot tub. But if tomorrow something happened where I lost all that, I am fully intact, spiritually, mentally, emotionally. I enjoy the challenge of change, of rebuilding. You know, I think of the Maharal of Prague, you know, the Jewish mystic who talks about letting the spiritual lead the physical and not letting the physical lead the spiritual. I think of the non-attachment principles in Buddhism and being conditioned by impermanence. I think of the Apostle Paul and his emphasis on being content in all things, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're free or in prison. And that is my core. And then I only softly identify with the external attachments in my life. At least I try to. Obviously, I'm not perfect, but that's my disposition that I aim for. And I don't try to attach myself too much to anything that can be taken away, that can be destroyed, that can be dismantled, that can be reshuffled by external forces.
It's interesting. As I get older, I find myself being more of a minimalist. I just have accumulated all this stuff and I find myself giving it away and just don't need it. I do a decent amount of traveling for work. And I said, if I can be away for 3 days and not have this stuff, why do I have it at all? And it's separating right. yourself from these attachments. It's just not necessary. How did you get into spy novels?
All right. That's an interesting question. So yeah, I think it was at a time in my life where, again, things were falling apart, right? I was, I had shifted away from doing my record labels full time because a lot of trouble I had in that business. And I shifted from doing it full time and having it more being like a passive ownership of IP rights and had lay off all my staff wow. and pursue another career path, got into finance, started my own financial planning practice. So again, hunting and killing every day, no guaranteed salary. I was wow. in the Midwest. And, that takes 3 to 5 years to really build that up in a stable way. I was 2 years in when the 2008 financial crisis hit. I was in the auto belt, Toledo, Ohio, close to Detroit. As goes Detroit, so goes Toledo. Mm. Lots of Jeep workers. They're closing out their accounts. And I was working harder than ever. But, my revenue slash income started going down, down, down. And so, you can take chaos and negative circumstances, and you can do one of two things. You can sulk, or you can pivot, and you can find something else to dive into. So at night, when the kids would go to bed between 10 and 1 in the morning, I was reading a lot of spy novels and kind of having a healthy escape in that genre. Vince Flynn, Brad Thor, Ted Bell, Daniel Silva, those type of things. And of course, this is all, we're at the height of the post 9/11 anti-terrorism era, and Kiefer Sutherland on 24 and all of that stuff, right? So there's a lot of kind of, imagination attached to that zeitgeist. And I was reading them. I was like, I can do this. So I just started writing a spy novel. And, I started in 2007, didn't end up finishing it till 2015 amongst many life changes and starts and stops. And self-published it. And, that was my foray to that. I've written another one since that I haven't released yet because I pivoted to failure rules, but at some point that'll come out. So I haven't given up on doing that. But right now I am, I think, fully passionate and immersed in kind of evangelizing the failure stuff here.
Really, there's two different styles of writing, fiction and nonfiction, right? I mean, how did you do that pivot? That's incredible.
I just did it.
I see.
So it's like when you read a lot of one genre, you start to get a feel on the rhythms and how to potentially approach it. And, I began pivoting to reading more nonfiction. At some point, I don't even know how it started. I think it's probably reading James Altucher's book, Choose Yourself. And then Srinivas Rao's The Art of Being Unmistakable. Those two books really were the catalyst for me, getting the idea and feeling convicted that I needed to write a book of the value of failure, because those books have really touched me. And then I started reading like similar books, whether it was, Ryan Holiday or, even like from Rabbi Daniel Lappin, Thou Shalt Prosper, or Rich Roll's book, and just getting into that genre and finding the diversity in that. And I love the intersection of business and art and creativity. Because, you have these business books that are all buttoned up and all suit-like and talking about how to succeed and don't mention failure. And then you have this whole genre where it's real and success is part of it. And that's the goal. But success might be defined a little differently. And there's this mix of how do I also have meaning in my life and marry money with meaning, right? And that being more of a focus. You need the money, you want the money, but it's a byproduct. But the meaning is first and foremost. And discovering this world of thought really just enraptured me. And I internalized it, lived it out in my own life. And then I just began to document it throughout Failure Rules with my own story and, a whole bunch of case studies with very diverse, focuses.
Yes.
Yeah.
You make it sound simple, Andrew. Your second rule, nothing is safe. Perhaps my favorite. I mean, my... the points that I wrote down here to discuss, I mean, mind the failure inside. Glorifying safety produces shallowness. I mean, yeah, I got to take a deep breath after that. I mean, that's some deep stuff, my friend.
Yeah. So, yeah, we talk about minding the fire inside. So similar to what we talked about before. Yeah. Don't let it out prematurely. You are the keeper of your flames. Guard them. Don't let them be susceptible to unnecessary reflexive negative input, right? Be careful who you tell your ideas to. They're precious if they're going to birth anything. And then secondly, you know, I kind of coined this term safety file in the book, which is, you know, a lover of safety above all things. And I do believe that that produces shallowness. I believe that that is an inhibitor of loud, authentic living. It's an inhibitor of really living out a life that is vibrant and can manifest your highest use in the world. And it doesn't mean that you should chase danger, just like you shouldn't chase failure. Safety has its place, but it ought not be first all the time for, you know, only the reason of fear, for only the reason of avoiding failure and difficulty and conflict. There are things that are of higher value than just safety. Mike Rowe, you know, the guy, you know, from Dirty Jobs, he does a show called Safety Third, or he did it years ago. And, you know, the idea wasn't that safety ought to be third or that it can never be first. It was like, let's just take a step back and look at safety and not just say safety first all the time. Because there are many times in life where safety ought not be first. There's other competing values that are higher than safety, and you still want to be as safe as possible, but you cannot let that rule the day. You know, if you're going to really do difficult things and try to chase uniqueness and greatness, it's just, it can't be the highest priority. Hmm. It's got to be subordinated.
Being comfortable is overrated. When unloved, sing your own love songs. Does that come from experience, right, Andrew?
Yeah. So I think being comfortable is overrated, even for one who likes to punctuate a life of challenge with lots of comfort. I like the stress of working all day in what I call a VUCA environment, full of volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And then I also like sitting in my hot tub at night, smoking a cigar, and thinking about it. So I do like to blend, you know, comfort with discomfort, but the discomfort has more meaning. And the comfort only has pleasure when it's followed by the discomfort. For me, it's got to be the contrast. It's the yin and the yang. It's both of them. In terms of, you know, when unloved, sing your own love songs. I mean, that really comes from kind of the sting of my own marital failure from my first marriage and the divorce. There's a song by one of my favorite punk bands, Sheer Terror. It's called The Love Songs for the Unloved. So it's inspired by that. I got a tattoo of that after my divorce. And it was just this notion of just reaffirming your self-love, not some like corny kind of like new age way, but in a very real, tangible, visceral way, realizing that it all starts with you recognizing your unique value. You're knit together in your mother's womb. You are one of one. You're a limited edition. You are, you know, you are unique. You need to own that every day. And then, you know, what you imprint on the world starts there. You have to build that up first. So I detail in the book, Kamal Ravikant, Silicon Valley investor, his story of he failed as a CEO, super depressed, was, you know, couldn't get out of bed. He was falling into the abyss. Was living off his credit cards, was neglecting outreach from family and friends. At a certain point, he embraced this idea of changing the loops in his head and learning to love himself. He wrote the book, Love Yourself Like Your Life Depends on It. That book, it's only like 8,000 words. And $1.99, I think he sold it for, or what have you, or $2.99, I don't know. And he sold 500,000 copies. So not only did he embrace this practice that, you know, from a psychological standpoint, was going to get him out of the abyss. But then as many artists do, or many creatives do, they turn their pain and their lessons into monetizable art. And then the art itself, reflecting his pivot, was what really financially got him out of that pit. And I think that that's the way we need to view our pain and our failure is, what can we turn this into? It's almost like Jack Nicholson in the movie The Departed, where he's, I'm an artist. You give me anything, I'll get something out of it. So that's how I approach life. You give me something, you give me failure, you give me wabi-sabi, the imperfection of life, or as David Lee Roth calls it, you know, it's perfect because it's a little fucked up. You give me that, I'm going to turn it into something, you know? You give me a lot of failures in life, I'm going to find lessons, I'm going to turn them into rules, and I'm going to write a book about it, and I'm going to go with Joey Pinn's podcast and talk about it.
Very cool. And perhaps my favorite lesson from that you know, failure from number two is know your operating system and own it. So know thyself, Shakespeare's own.
Yeah. So, I mean, that kind of comes from, you know, thinking about what is the framework of, you know, what do you refer to when failure comes, when hard times come, when the difficulties come? Do you have, you know, an operating system, so to speak? Yeah. And I reference the non-faith tradition of Stoicism and how Tim Ferriss leans on that. I reference, Hare Krishna and veganism and how John Joseph, the triathlete, punk rocker, you know, relies on that. I reference Christianity. Now, Dave Ramsey, you know, relied on that when he went through bankruptcy and still tithed walking into bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. I mean, who does that?
Wow.
Right? You're bankrupt and you're still going to give money away? Sure. Who does that, yeah. Right? But he had this operating system to help him walk through failure with some predetermined, disciplined guardrails. And I think, you know, certainly not all operating systems are equal, but you got to figure out what yours is. You got to define it, and you got to have that in your back pocket to reference, when the hard times strike.
When you were selecting bands and artists for the record label, what was that process like? How did you know that they were good enough to invest money and time in?
Well, in the beginning, I don't think I knew, right? I mean, I knew what I liked, and I think passion probably overrode financial analysis. Mm. Over time, I learned to blend the two. But it was really a labor of love for the most part. And it's like a lot of businesses where 20% of your choices drive 80% of your revenue, right, to help you recoup from and make money off the other 80% that might not have, recouped. And that's pretty much how it went. But over the arc of time, ups and downs, I look back and it was an amazing journey. Still continues to be wildly enjoyable. And, there's like at least 10 to 15 bands that I still can't believe I worked with. They're bands I listened to ever since I was like 15, 16.
Wow.
And had really influenced my life and impacted me. I mean, even in the book, I have a companion soundtrack playlist that's, yes, on Spotify and Apple Music. And there's a few bands on there that are my record label. I mean, they mean that much to me that their songs and lyrics actually buoyed me during my own times of struggle and hard times and failure.
Sure. Motorhead's on there. It's a great, it's a great soundtrack. Great list. Number three, money is spiritual, just tying along what you just said right there, lessons from punk rock and Son of a Preacher Man, you get what you give.
Yeah. So money is spiritual actually came from, Rabbi Daniel Lapin, his book, Thou Shalt Prosper. I don't think it was actually coined in that book, but that book really influenced me. And he said on an interview somewhere, he talked about how money is spiritual. And that really struck me. And so I thought a lot about that and how money is really, when used properly, it's a thank you note. It's an enabler, mm-hmm, of blessings. It's a multiplication of blessings. If you don't edge into the failure territory of envy and greed, which I talk a lot about in the book, and the dangers of envy and greed. And I think a lot of people like to focus on greed, but they don't like to focus on envy, and they're equally dangerous. I mean, they're malevolent twin siblings, right? I think if we stop demonizing and stop worshiping money, we can actually use it for what it's worth, that it is really a magical tool to uplift us, to bless others, and to really be a thank you note. I mean, I quote John Stossel in the book where, yeah, he says, it's really all transactions really are, meant, mm-hmm, are usually, both the buyer and seller think they're going to win.
Right.
Even if they're not, right, they both don't get into it. They're voluntary. They think they're going to win. Yeah. Right. And so I think there is this element of money where if we view it that way, we can have more power over it and use it as a tool and not let it really kind of, inappropriately overcome our lives.
Mm. And then your fourth rule, you really talk about, prevention strategy and building dependencies. You call it thing one and thing two. It's just talk about, the enabler pursuit and your priority pursuit. It's how did you arrive at these? It's so clever. It's just so clever, Andrew, the way you kind of formulated these into these strategies.
Well, the interesting thing is, I wrote the stories first. So I wrote my kind of stories first, and I went back and massaged them, refined them. Mm. And then I was like, okay, well, what's the actual lesson here? And then I was able to extract a lesson, expound on that. And then I layered in relevant case studies And then I saw patterns of certain rules that could roll up from there, right? So it was a revelatory kind of process over the years before I got to the final structure, which I think is, you know, came out really cohesively.
Yes.
So for failure rule number four, you're right, it's called thing one and thing two dependency. It's a failure prevention strategy. And thing one and thing two makes it sound like I read Cat in the Hat all day, which I don't. It's nothing to do with Cat in the Hat. I actually had like Tony Soprano in mind, lighting his first cigar of the day, like, you know, talking in, you know, Italian-American slang and saying, hey, there's the thing one and the thing two, you do this and then you do that, right? I mean, that's kind of what was in my mind. And thing one is your enabler pursuit, which is kind of the scaffolding, the undergirding that allows you stability, cut your teeth and learning. It might be a low or low meaning pursuit, but it's something that allows you to then move more safely towards your North Star pursuit, which might represent the highest usefulness you have to give to the world. And so then I gave kind of examples of that, right? So one example I gave of these two brothers that I know, you know, they're anonymized in the book, but they were of a Shia Muslim background, moved to the States, and they needed startup seed money to kind of build their own businesses and retail empire. And so how did they get that? They worked for Disney on Ice for several years, which paid for their lodging and paid for the food. Every night they're traveling, selling princess swag to moms and little girls on the road, but they had no expenses. They were able to save all that money. They came back with that cash pile and they invested it into what ended up being over the arc of time, the retail empire. I mean, they own gyms, they own gas stations, they own cigar lounges, all kinds of stuff. And it was because they had this vision of the enabler pursuit, right? Mm. Low meaning, but it gave them the seed money, also adds to the richness of their narrative to explain their entrepreneurial path, which I think is kind of this intangible, like amazing kind of element of embracing the strategy. So that was one example. The other was Chris Wren from Bridge Nine Records, who launched his record labels by making Yankee Sucks merchandise and selling it to Red Sox fans. That endeavor was entirely to underwrite his record label. Some might call it, you know, taking good money and chasing after bad, but that's how he pursued his passion. He had to do a lower meaning thing to enable and mobilize his higher meaning thing. And we have to think creatively like that as entrepreneurs and creatives, because there's no real blueprint. You don't just go to school and get a degree and next thing you know, you're a comedian. Like, you got to find these circumventive punk rock paths to figure out how to make shit happen.
Yeah, you mentioned Tony Soprano. He has a great quote that I forgot that he said. If you can quote the rules, then you can obey them.
That's right.
That's just it's wonderfully simple and logically logical. And number five, you are not your failures. Impress management. Detach from the optics of failure. We just kind of talked about that in the beginning, how this our society just kind of punishes the loser of a football game or, you know, or whatever, you know, the loser versus the winner. But you say detach it, rejection is fuel.
Yeah. So for that one, I mean, there's a lot of examples that kind of come to mind, right? But I think that really is a handicap for people, particularly once they go through the failure. They just think my reputation is tarnished. The perception of my talent and ability is tarnished by an event that may or may not have occurred because of my own dereliction or gaps in decision making. Sometimes that's part of it. Other times it's just the luck of the draw. It's just how, you know, the circumstances converge. And we really need to detach ourselves from our failure events, right? We need to have our own self-worth guarded from those events. Doesn't mean we don't learn from them. If we did contribute to their occurrence, then we need to evaluate that and try to correct that. Sure, of course. I think it's particularly difficult for those that have ethical and moral failures to detach from the optics of failure. They got a tougher road to hoe. And so I detail one example of the book of ex-gang leader Elgin James, mixed race kid from New England. Actually, is the brother of half brother of Jocko Willink. I've come to find out.
Really?
He was a gang leader of a straight edge hardcore punk gang. Straight edge is a subculture of hardcore punk that doesn't engage in drinking or smoking or. Some of them even, you know, extra premarital sex. But they had kind of this Puritan bent on some of them, right? And this was one of that variety where they would, you know, kind of terrorize you know, anybody doing drugs or drinking at shows and beat them up. And then they got into extortion and it got really, really negative and really, really ugly. I mean, it was a gang. They were on an episode of Gangland on the History Channel. And Elgin was like the founder. It was called FSU, which alternately meant Friends Stand United and Fuck Shit Up. But then Elgin's path changed. He kind of, he denounced violence, denounced the gang, and had the courage to like see himself differently, deal with the consequences of his past, but also move forward and craft a new reputation, realizing he is not his failures. Failure rule number five. Hmm. He ended up going to Hollywood, becoming a screenwriter. Robert Redford became his mentor. Wow. He ended up writing scripts for, I think, Lowriders was one, and then more well-known, he wrote the Mayans MC, which is a spinoff to FX's Sons of Anarchy. Hmm. He did end up going to jail for an extortion charge, and on the day of his sentencing, he kind of talked about the paradox or the irony of him going away on the same day he got to deal with Universal Pictures and the juxtaposition of his old life and his new life. So it's like stories of that, like that, where he had the courage to deal with his failures, own them, but also realize you are not your failures and move forward and find a path where he actually could manifest his highest uniqueness and calling in the world. And so those stories to me are kind of inspirational, kind of really illustrate, you know, what I mean when I say, you know, you are not your failures. That's failure rule number five. You need to understand that.
Mm. When you hit a rock, let it push you to a new stream.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's, you know, somewhat of a common, you know, word picture to understand. But it's this idea of like, you know, kind of like when you're in a car and you hit black ice, you don't want to put the brakes on. It's actually going to make it worse. Sometimes you just got to submit to that, find out where it's going to take you. And that might actually be your safest path, even if it's still not very safe. And I think sometimes when we hit rock bottom, it's very similar. We might have a tendency to want to hold on to what is falling apart, to what is breaking away, to what is disassembling. And sometimes the best thing is to do is actually hit the rock and see where what's new stream it pushes you into, and then embrace that new stream with openness and curiosity and find what that next version of yourself is going to be as you fall into that new stream and stop clinging to the old that is being broken away, sometimes without our understanding as to why. I mean, there might be a divine purpose that is happening, and you know, if your inclination is to even believe in such things, right? So that's really the concept of that chapter.
And perhaps my favorite quote in your book from the wonderful, wonderful comedian, divorcee, victim of anti-Semitic bullying, and aluminum side salesman, of course, Rodney Dangerfield, if you'll indulge me. You know, I told a psychiatrist that everyone hates me. He said I was being ridiculous. Everyone hasn't met me yet.
Right.
Wonderful.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting case study, right? But the fact that he was like in his 50s and he's, you know, divorced and, you know, he's all this family history or this, you know, childhood history of being bullied for being Jewish. And, you know, he's got that inside of him. And, but, you know, he did not give up on like this internal spirit voice, you know, calling him to a life of comedy. And so when it manifested, it was like this really unique blue collar, I call it failure comedy. It's failure humor, right? And you know, he was the master of that. I mean, self-deprecating, I mean, him with the facial expressions and everything else.
No respect.
And, you know, you look like Easy Money. It was all about the juxtaposition between, you know, the working class slobs and the upper class snobs and just that whole genre that he kind of, I think in my mind, typified for us older guys who remember how amazing Rodney was. So you know, I look at him as almost like the king of failure humor, and you know, there's modern incarnations. I went and saw Bill Burr play in June and strangely ended up running into him at the hotel I was staying at and had a cigar with him for about 10 to 15 minutes. I explained to him the concept of failure humor and he's like, that's exactly what I do. You got it right on. You know, it's failure humor. Right. So, you know, I think the term has weight, right? I think that's really what it kind of is. And it's a mechanism to deal with your failures. You got to, you know, have some fun with it sometimes, even if they're really bad. Yeah. I mean, you know, I talk about in the book, like sometimes you need to take yourself less seriously to seriously put your life back together again. And that was true for me when I was going through really, really hard times of business falling apart and you know, losing my home and transitioning from one state to another. I mean, I just really indulged in a lot of self-deprecating humor and was, you know, watching a lot of Rescue Me with Dennis Leary on it, and listening to other comedians. And that was a, like, you know, a balm for me that really helped me. And I think that can be a good tool to get through failure.
It humbles you as well, I think. Yeah. So on the podcast, you mentioned it in the beginning, we talk, you know, I always bring up discipline. You know, I lost a lot of weight. People ask me how. I kind of opened the conversation with, you know, what had to happen for you to see failure as such a great teacher. And for me, you know, for me to lose all the weight, the doctor had to tell me, look, you're not going to see your daughter graduate. You know, you're pre-diabetic, you're pre-hypertensive. So that was the moment where I said, this is not going to happen. I may change. By the way, I kept it all to myself. I didn't tell anybody what I was doing. I just did it.
Yep.
And so people want a quick remedy. And, you know, obesity is a serious issue. You're a former bodybuilder. You know a lot about nutrition and exercise. But more importantly, my answer is always quick to say discipline and focus. I wonder, I mean, you've gone through such bottoms. You were on assistance for a while, right? You talked about failures in your home and businesses. I wonder where it played a role then and where it plays a role now.
I think the biggest discipline for me is, no matter how busy I get, how wide my pursuit stack stretches, particularly in the good times, which I've had for quite some time now, I'm thankful for, is to always reserve dedicated surpluses of silent time. You know, whether that's through exercise, going on a bike ride or a hike or lifting weights or hanging out in my hot tub and having a cigar, introspection, reflection, meditation, prayer, whatever it is so important to, again, peg you back to your operating system, which you need to define so that can keep you grounded, because the ground will shift on certain things. Maybe not fall back to, you know, more, you know, catastrophes, right? But the ground will shift, and you got to have that spiritual grounding. That being in touch with yourself, knowing thyself, knowing who you are, what you're doing, coming back to non-attachment, particularly when attachments have grown around your life and things are good and there's material prosperity. And so to me, that's like my biggest discipline right now is through a long stretch of prosperity to really never forget what the hard times and the failures taught me, which is a lot of the reason I wrote this book, because it's those lessons that really bring the meaning to the experiences. And I think really help shape my character now as I go forward into, you know, good times. I think that would be my biggest discipline.
Yeah. It's a fascinating take. And just the discipline of failing fast, learning and moving on. We can't really, you know, under discuss that, right? It's very important. I mean, many people will fail and just, you know, walk away and that's it. But it just takes a strong mind and a strong discipline to kind of keep going like that, which you've done. You've exercised.
And I think that's been one of the skills that I've learned is leveraging chaos as an idea engine, the chaos of failure, the chaos of messiness, to not view it as things falling apart only, but to view it as an opportunity. Right. So I write about that in the book, and, you know, I can think about one particular time where, you know, I had gone through a business divorce and my divorce path with my wife was a fast follow. And I was living in a hotel room. All of a sudden I had no office to report to by day, no home to go through, you know, to go home to at night. Wow. And what do you do in that situation? Well, you can wallow in it. You can be depressed, or you can leverage that chaos as an idea engine. So I use that solitude to, you know, make my plans, and they were multi-pronged. And within that time, I developed plans that bore fruit over time. So I used that chaos to leverage that. It was in that time that I ended up starting a consulting business in the online lending space, which led into forming a lead generation company that was very lucrative. It was in that time that I finished my spy novel and began networking at, Thriller Fest in New York City. It's during that time that I decided to reinvest in my record labels and release a few more records. It was at that time that I really shaped up my resume and networked and landed the job I have today as an executive fintech banker. So the fruit that came out of that failure space, of that chaos, of that surplus of solitude, was just amazing, right? But it did take discipline to do that. It took the experience of going through failures in the past to know that you can't just stay in them. You have to find a way to be optimistic and see the opportunities in them.
As a youth, as you're creating the record labels, as you're writing the spy novels, as you're doing all this, did you consider yourself a strongly disciplined person? Did you have that discussion with yourself? Did you consider yourself that?
Yeah, I think I did.
Yeah,
I think I did for sure. I mean, I do get compulsive when I get excited and passionate about something. I mean,
bodybuilding,
whether it was training for bodybuilding or when I was doing the record label. I mean, you know, I remember one band that was really popular that ended up being a really high selling artist for me when I was courting them and trying to get them to sign with my label. One time, you know, the guy called me back. He said, "Man, your drive is insane. You left like 3 messages on my phone every day for the past 15 days, you know?" Wow. So yeah, a little compulsive at times. I've tempered that now as I've gotten older, but you know, there was just this relentlessness in me when I was after something. I don't know if it's just discipline. It's probably a combination of discipline and, you know,
drive,
passionate compulsion.
Passion, yeah, absolutely.
And drive, yeah.
Andrew Thorpe King, what motivates you?
I'll go back to trying to marry money with meaning. You know, I think that a lot of people sacrifice one for the other. And I think if you have money and no meaning, there's going to be an emptiness there that's going to be hard to sustain. And I think if you have meaning with no money, there's going to be a struggle there that's hard to maintain. Mm. And so for me, trying to continually balance, you know, money and viewing it as spiritual, avoiding the edges of greed and envy, and at the same time, trying to maximize meaning in my life so that I can really, you know, fulfill my highest purpose. That drives me, balancing those two things to live a full, authentic, big, loud life.
And how do you measure success?
Ah, that's a very good question. So I actually define that in the definition of terms in the book.
Yeah.
And I define it uniquely, where success is not a worldly success based on your net worth. It's not based on what you have. It's based on, are you successfully aligning yourself with your calling journey? Right. And so that's a little bit of a ethereal concept, but it's this idea of, you know, at every touch point in your life where there's some decision making to be had that's going to change the trajectory of your next steps, are you making the decision that are going to align you with the highest meaning in your life and the most unique application of your unique talent stack and gifts in the world that no other or not many others can give the world in the way that you can? So that's how I define success. Doesn't really have anything to do with money. We've talked about how money is important, but to me, that success is aligning with that calling journey at every touch point and every decision point. And that's a lot of what the book's about.
It certainly is. You know, when I finally found out, you know, we were going to have this talk, this conversation, I read the book, I went through your videos, I said, wow, this is going to be great. I mean, because, you know, I started my business back in the 90s, and there's been certain failures too. You don't get accounts, you fail with employees, you fail with, you know, there's always those kind of failures. And to kind of sum it up the way you did so succinctly with these lessons and these, you know, quotes from others, it's so well done. It's so well put together. I really enjoyed it. I want people to enjoy it as well. How can we get in touch with you, Andrew?
So I'll hold the book up here. Yeah. It's Failure Rules, the 5 Rules of Failure for Entrepreneurs, Creatives, and Authentics. You can find me online at andrewthorpeking.com. No E on the end of Thorpe, just Thorp. The book is out everywhere. The books can be sold online, audiobook, hardcover, every format, ebook. And you can find me on YouTube at Andrew Thorpe King, and also on Instagram. So YouTube, Instagram, my website, and obviously Amazon. So go buy the book. Also, I have the merchandise company, Soul on Fire Supply Company, some kick-ass merch attached to the themes of the book. You can also find that on my website, AndrewThorpeKing.com.
Andrew, I really enjoy it. So next time I'm in Philly, we're going to have some bourbon, And,
yes, we are.
And have a great time. I really enjoyed our conversation today. I was looking so forward to it. Thanks so much for your time today. We know how to get in touch with you. I look forward to meeting you face to face. Thanks again. You be well.
Thanks, Joey. Appreciate it. Have a good night.
Thank you for listening and or viewing Joey Pinn's Discipline Conversations. Please share this episode with one or two of your friends who you think may benefit from the episode. Our website, www.joeypins.com. There you find lots of resources and you could join our mailing list. Please follow us on all our social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Podcast information, the video version of our podcast is on YouTube. Please subscribe. Audio is on all major podcasting platforms. Please follow them. And if you like it, please consider giving 5-star rating. Would really appreciate that. Would you like to financially support the podcast? You can go to our Patreon site. Consider $5, $10, or $20 a month. There's all kind of plans that we have there. There's like a one-time payment. What is this podcast episode worth to you? $25, $50, $100, $500, $1,000, $5,000. You be the judge. You can go to our PayPal account to do that as well. Thank you again for listening or watching Joey Pinn's Discipline Conversations.